So we've come to the time of the year when most of the big movies are already out for the summer. In fact, all of the big movies are out for the summer. And we're turning the corner in the next few weeks into what they call the quality movie time of the year. September, October, November, and then the big December Christmas releases and the desperate attempts to get nominated for Academy Awards. In the meantime, there are no blockbusters opening up this weekend, except for one animated movie, which neither Max nor I saw. So here's the big movie that we have to review for you. It's the third movie in a series of movies made by Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon and director Michael Winterbottom. Started in 2010 with a movie called The Trip. A couple of years later, they did a sequel called The Trip to Italy. And now they're back with a third movie called The Trip to Spain. Max and I both saw the press screening of this the other night, at which Max told me he had not seen either of the two previous movies, which surprised me. Mm-hmm. I thought that these would be the kind of movies you would like.
Surprised me, too.
So I'm going to let you take the lead here because you knew nothing about these movies, and you can talk about them the way many people who might go see this would, having no knowledge of the previous two.
This has been a journey of discovery for me, and usually that's not the case. As you point out, I know a lot about films before going in, and I have some preconceived notions. Sometimes I'm happy, sometimes I'm sad with the finished product, but with this one, I really wasn't sure what to expect. Now, I'm not very familiar with Rob Brydon. I know he's much more popular over in the UK. He was a Home Shopping Network host for a while, and then he got into comedy writing. He was on the original version of Gavin and Stacey, which was rebooted here with Thomas Hayden Church and Deborah Messing, but it died because Americans can't do British comedy. But he's well known over there, and his co-star here is Steve Coogan. And Steve Coogan has, as you pointed out last hour, done incredible work in movies such as Tropic Thunder and Hamlet 2, and of course the Oscar-nominated Philomena with Judi Dench, which they reference in this movie, which in a hilarious sense. And so I love him a whole lot. And I was aware of the Trip movies, but I had never got around to watching them. And so when the third one came out, the third one is out today. And when the screening invite was sent out, I thought to myself, even though there's no screenwriters credited on these movies, because they're improvised movies by and large.
Right. The way it works is the two stars and the director outline the scenes that they want to do. And then he just points the camera in these beautiful scenarios, mm-hmm. and they kind of ad-lib their way and improvise their way through it. I'm sure there are multiple takes because there are multiple camera angles.
But I was still uncomfortable in going to see what amounted to the third in a trilogy of movies without seeing one and two. So thankfully, the first film, simply called The Trip, and the second film, titled The Trip to Italy, are both on Netflix.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a Netflix account. So a couple days ago, I fired up the first one. I hit play. I'm watching it with my wife. We're watching it. We're like, Steve Coogan, this is going to be great. We're watching it. About 20 minutes in, I hit stop. And I was so let down and disappointed because I found this scenario for that first film so uncomfortable. They didn't like each other. He didn't even want to bring Rob Brydon on the trip because he was trying to bring a woman to impress her, and then that fell through. And I just got really uncomfortable with it, and they were doing goofy voices, and I thought, what is this movie? So I shut it off, and I thought, that's fine. I'll go see the third one. Who cares? Well, and we can talk about the nuts and bolts of why we both enjoyed this film, because we did, but I loved this third movie.
I have to say, when he says he loved this movie, I was sitting two seats away from him.
Yep.
And Max and I have been to many press screenings together where we've sat relatively close to each other, but we never talk about the movie because we want it to be fresh when we come on the air here.
Yeah.
So I don't know what he's felt about it, and he doesn't know what I felt about it, but I've never heard Max laugh out loud as much as you did at this movie.
There are multiple laugh out loud moments that come out of nowhere that I was very, very happy with. And what's great about this third film is they now want to be on this trip together. Of course, they have such a natural rapport with one another, and they have tons of inside jokes that they're referring back to that I didn't get because I didn't watch the other two movies.
Mm-hmm.
But I found myself really engaged, and really that the whole thing was compelling and beautiful, and the food looked amazing.
Yep.
And I really fell in love with this movie.
Okay, now before you go on,
yes,
Dan hasn't seen any of these movies, correct?
No.
But you have heard the clips that I've played of Steve Coogan and Rob Brydon doing their spot-on Michael Caine impressions.
Oh, yes.
Those are the famous clips. They've gone viral.
Okay.
Well, in this one, you get a tiny little bit of Michael Caine and some other people who I'll mention in a moment. But the set piece in the middle of this movie is when the two of them do dueling Roger Moores.
Oh.
Now, Roger Moore just died a couple of months ago. Here's a scene where they're in this fantastic Spanish restaurant. The waitress has just brought them over an appetizer where there's one scallop each for them. And it's a scallop with, I think it's Iranian caviar. And she describes all this stuff. Doesn't matter. It just looks fantastic. And the two of them go into their Roger Moores.
Go first.
No. Please, you go first.
Well, before I do, Scaramango, why don't I turn them that way? In which case, should you have interfered with my scallop?
My country, it is always traditional that the nearest scallop is served to the guest.
Where I come from, it is a custom to proffer the larger scallop to the guest.
In my country, when such an offer is made, it is traditional to turn the plate round twice and replace it on the table.
Come, Mr. Bond. You enjoy the scallop just as much as I do. Please, eat.
Bottoms up.
Goodbye, Mr. Bond. Mr. Bond, goodbye.
You should pay more attention to your chef. He's working for Her Majesty's government.
Now, you're an impressionist. Those are damn good Roger Moores, aren't they?
Oh, heck yeah.
And the way that they do it and just wing it and throw in, you know.
Really, really great.
Oh, it's just fantastic. And there are several set pieces like that. Not only do they do the Roger Moore stuff, but they have a couple of callbacks with Mick Jagger. One of them trying to teach the other one how to do Mick Jagger. They do the same for John Hurt, who also just recently died. Marlon Brando, David Bowie, Monty Python, Spanish Inquisition, because they're in Spain. And there are several of those throughout the movie.
I went back home and I watched. I thought, you know what? I'm going to watch these backwards, which I've never done with a trilogy that I haven't seen. So I watched Trip to Italy and really, really enjoyed it. I thought it was so much more fun than what I saw from that first movie. There's a recurring gag with an iPod that doesn't work, and they have to listen to Alanis Morissette for most of the trip, and that's really great stuff. So then I finally watched The Trip, the very first one.
The one you'd given up on.
Yes, the one that I thought, I'm not going to enjoy these movies at all, and I have to watch three of them. After enjoying parts two and three, that first one is even better because you can see how they came together to be such good friends over the course of 17 years.
Yeah.
So I think I would recommend to Dan Strauss and to anybody listening, to Tim, to Jose, to watch these movies in reverse order.
In reverse. Yeah.
Meaning, go right now to go see The Trip to Spain at the Plaza Frontenac, and then if you enjoy it and laugh as much as Paul and I did, then you can watch parts two and three, or I'm sorry, two and one on Netflix.
Now, yeah. I will say this about the movie. I have a couple of things to add about the movie, because those scenes where they're doing their impressions, or just when they're driving along, you can tell they have that camaraderie of old friends who get under each other's skin and jab at each other verbally and otherwise, and it's really, really funny. But there are some serious subplots, including Steve Coogan's son, about Steve Coogan's son and Coogan's love life and his career obstacles and his successes like Philomena, which is a callback in here after he won two Oscar nominations for that. Meanwhile, Rob Brydon, the other guy, is this happily married father of two whose success has been mostly limited to Britain, as Max said. And while Steve Coogan is fighting with his agent over getting a new screenplay produced, Rob Brydon is in his hotel room content to FaceTime with his wife in bed. So it's two very different characters going through this. Now, here's the bad thing about this movie. The last 10 minutes, when they have parted ways and Steve Coogan moves on to something else, that it goes nowhere, and then the movie ends suddenly for no reason.
It's a baffling ending, and I don't want to go into spoilers, but given a conversation they have earlier that sort of relates to this out-of-nowhere ending, I don't know what they were trying to say
with it.
And it's baffling.
Here's the problem. When you go see these movies, you've signed on for two funny guys, and you end up with one not being funny guy and it just ends.
Very strange ending.
Yeah, they should have just chopped it when they get back and they part ways. That should just be the end of the movie, as it was in the first two.
The only negative thing that I can say about the trip to Spain and also trip to Italy and the original trip is every single time I felt like these two had worn out their welcome. It was almost like taking an actual road trip with friends or family. By about Thursday, you're done with them, and they get sort of annoying. Same thing with these two. And I was saying to a friend of mine after the screening, I think I would enjoy the trip to Spain so much more as a television show if I could just check in like once a week. Like, I wonder what they're eating now and where they're at. And my friend goes, that's what these are. Over in the UK, these are television seasons.
It started out as a TV show where they went on various adventures. And
there were six 30-minute episodes that were edited together for the foreign market. We are the foreign market.
Yes.
So even Trip to Spain was a television show that you could watch in installments, which I think would be incredible and so much better.
See, I would like to hang out with these guys, even through their serious moments. They're just fun to be with. I hope they keep traveling. I hope they keep going out somewhere again in two more years.
Oh, they have to, because this ending... This can't be the ending of the trilogy.
Oh,
they
no.
have to do another one.
Absolutely. I agree. What do you give it on a scale of 10?
I would give this an 8 on a scale of 10.
Me too.
Yeah?
Yeah. Usually I give these movies higher. The 10 minutes at the end knocked it down a notch for me to an 8 out of 10.
It's a bit long, so I would say 8.
It's called The Trip to Spain. Dan, I really think you'd enjoy it.
Is it wide release?
It's a Plaza Frontenac kind of movie.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right.
Art houses?
Yeah.
So what's the animation that's opening this week that you guys haven't seen?
Well, for
it's
a long
called
time,
Leap.
Yeah, it was called Ballerina for a long time, and I think in other territories it's still called Ballerina. It's who is it? It's not Sony, is it? It's somebody's trying to get into animation. Sony's already been in animation, but it's a studio that says we're going to be the next Disney, and now they've retitled this Leap, and it's about a young ballerina who falls in love and has to save the world. I did not see it.
Sounds great.
I didn't see it either.
I think it's based on a true story, Dan.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
You know what's funny? The first movie we've had in a long time that actually is a true story, The Trip to Spain,
yeah.
Dan doesn't ask us.
I know.
Right.
I figured it was.
The other movie that's out today, talk about art house movies. I don't think this will play at Plaza. I think this is going to be a Tivoli-only movie. Mm. It's a movie called Good Time. Do not let the title fool you. Good Time is anything but. It starts with... an actor named Benny Safdie, who you will not know. He plays a mentally challenged guy named Nick, who's in a conversation with his therapist. And pretty soon, Robert Pattinson bursts in as Nick's brother, Connie, and takes Nick out of there. And the next thing we know, Nick and Connie, the brothers, are trying to pull off a bank robbery, which they're not very good at. But they get away with a bag full of cash, not knowing that there's going to be the red dye marker in there. And, of course, when it explodes, the paint gets all over them, and they find themselves being chased by the cops, and things go downhill from there. The rest of the plot of this movie involves a case of mistaken identity, a soda bottle full of LSD, a weird trip to a closed amusement park, and all sorts of odd encounters reminiscent of what Griffin Dunne went through in the Martin Scorsese movie After Hours more than two decades ago. Unfortunately, Benny Safdie and his brother Josh, who co-wrote this with him and co-directed it with him, they're not Martin Scorsese. So what we're left with is a nightmare for both the characters on the screen and those of us in the theater watching this thing. And there's this pumped-up EDM score. I can't stand EDM music. I know it's a generational thing, but I cannot take it. And the guy who scored this, Daniel Lopatin is his name, it's almost as annoying as the story that it accompanies. I will say this. The only positive thing about this is Robert Pattinson's performance. I've never seen Robert Pattinson in anything. I didn't go to the Twilight movies because I'm not a 14-year-old girl. I didn't go to any of the other things that he's appeared in through the years. In this movie, Robert Pattinson captures Connie's ineptness and his intensity beautifully. His energy virtually leaps off the screen. It's just too bad that he's stuck in a funhouse of a movie without much redemption. And the same can be said of Jennifer Jason Leigh and Barkhad Abdi, who both have small supporting roles. Jennifer Jason Leigh was a star after Fast Times at Ridgemont High. Then her career kind of went sideways, but a couple of years ago she made Quentin Tarantino's Hateful Eight. She should have been able to get something better than this after that. And Barkhad Abdi was nominated for an Oscar for Captain Phillips, and I know the kind of roles he would be up for are kind of limited because of the kind of actor he is, But really, Barkhad, this is the best you can do. It's called Good Time. It is not a good time. 4 out of 10. Mostly for, or almost entirely for, Robert Pattinson's performance.
David Cronenberg did a film about 5 years ago called Cosmopolis. Very strange film. Pattinson is in almost every scene. He's pretty much driving in the back of a limo. He's riding in the back of a limo through this city that's falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
He's phenomenal in it. So if you liked him in Good Time, I would recommend Cosmopolis.
All right, more movies and TV stuff to get to as we continue with the Showbiz Show here on the Big 550 KTRS right after this. Didn't I just say I hate EDM music, Max?
That's why I had to play some for you.
Yeah. It's like the Steve Coogan, Rob Brydon thing. You've known each other long enough, you know what gets the other guy going.
I, too, am too old for this. I don't understand this music.
Then turn it off.
I don't understand this music. I don't understand this rock and roll music you kids are listening to.
The KTRS Nestle Purina Radiothon is going to happen next Wednesday, the 30th, 6 in the morning till 6 in the afternoon. During the Radiothon, you'll have the opportunity to bid on all sorts of unique opportunities and prizes. I guess if they're all sorts of unique, that can't be. Unique means one of a kind. But there are all sorts of amazing opportunities and prizes. You can make a difference right away by going to the KTRS website and click on the Radiothon tab. If you make a $200 donation, you will get 4 tickets to the September 13th Cardinals game and 4 tickets to 1 of 3 Blues preseason games. And you'll be entered into a drawing for 4 tickets to see Billy Joel at Busch Stadium on September 21st. If you added the price of those things up, that would be way more than the $200 you'd be donating for the KTRS Nestle Purina Radiothon. You can make a difference again by going to KTRS.com and click on the Radiothon tab. All right, we're back with the showbiz stuff here on the Big 550 KTRS. In the previous segment, Max and I both gave an 8 out of 10 to The Trip to Spain, which is open today, and I gave a 4 out of 10 to the Robert Pattinson movie Good Time. One thing I didn't mention about that, I saw in the credits a credit I've never seen before. Some guy listed way, way down in the credits, Ben Edelman as acid-buying complainer. That's the name of his role.
Wow.
Yeah. I didn't even get that when I was in Mississippi Grind. Dan didn't even get that when he was up in the air. So
no,
we can't complain, but how'd you like to have that on your resume? Man. Well, what kind of work have you done, Ben? Well, I was acid-buying complainer in Good Time.
I bought some acid. I wasn't happy with it.
And I complained.
I also want to mention that Jay Thomas died yesterday at the age of 69. Jay had a longtime radio career on the coasts, but he also had a lot of TV experience. When Mork and Mindy first came on the air with Robin Williams and Pam Dauber, they thought they needed a lot of wacky or not so wacky straight-laced characters on that show. Conrad Janis was on there as Mindy's father. He had a music store. And Mork and Mindy also used to go to this deli that was run by a guy named Dino and his sister. I can't remember who that actress was, but Jay Thomas played Dino on there. So he was on the first season of there. After a while, they realized, we don't need this. We have Robin Williams. Get rid of all these other people. Just have him go crazy. And later on, bring in Jonathan Winters, and you got a show. So, but Jay Thomas was on that. He was also on Cheers for a few seasons as Eddie LeBeck, who was Carla Tortelli's husband.
Oh, yeah.
Do you remember how he was a hockey player?
He was a goalie for the Bruins.
Yeah, he was a goalie for the Bruins who went off to go with like Disney on Ice or the Ice Capade or something.
Yeah, Penguin.
And you know how he died?
He got, by the Zamboni.
Run over by the Zamboni,
that's right.
There was a spinoff show called The Tortellis that only lasted a couple of episodes.
Yeah, with Dan Hedaya and Gene Kasem. Casey Kasem's wife.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah.
Jay Thomas was also on Murphy Brown, where he won 2 Emmys. He was also on a series called Love and War, which was a kind of a, not a spinoff of Murphy Brown, but Diane English, who was doing Murphy Brown, thought Jay Thomas was so good, and he won 2 Emmys for being on that she made a show for him called Love and War and had him co-starring with Susan Day from the Partridge Family. That did not work at all. So they fired her, and in the second season brought in Annie Potts. And their relationship worked a little bit better. It stayed on the air for a couple of years. Jay Thomas said that show, Love and War, will never be rerun or released on DVD because Diane English and Les Moonves, it was before he ran CBS, he was the head of Warner Brothers at the time, they hated each other, so no one will ever see that ever again. He was also in the movie Mr. Holland's Opus. Recently, he was on Ray Donovan on Showtime. But J. Thomas will always be remembered as the guy who went on David Letterman's final show of the year, every year, the Christmas episode, threw a football to knock a meatball off the top of a tree,
yeah,
and told what David Letterman said was the greatest guest story ever. He did it for something like 15 straight years. Here's one of those years.
When I was a young disc jockey, I would open up car dealerships, and I would do the remote, which you did, too, as a DJ and as a weatherman and all
let's,
that.
Let's go to J. Let's, Thomas
yeah,
now.
Come on
Ford.
Out to the Dodge dealer. It was Dodge. And so the Lone Ranger, Clayton Moore, was working for that company, and he would come to the various dealerships, and little kids would come. Mm-hmm.
This is the guy who played the Lone Ranger.
The real
television.
Lone Ranger. Right. And he was very much into being the Lone Ranger. He wore the outfit, he wore the mask, he had the guns, he had the hat, and he was into being the Lone Ranger. So I get there, and I'm telling people to come out, and the Lone Ranger is there, and it's not a high point in my career. I don't know where my life is going. I have long, frizzy hair, and I'm a disc jockey, and my buddy Mike Martin, who was in the record business and who looked sort of like a Bay City roller. He had the long, long hair and the stacked heels and tight pants, and he would come.
See, now that's a new point. I haven't heard that.
You know, I was just realizing
that. You never described him as a Bay City roller.
He looked like a Bay City roller, and he would do like this with his hair all the time, right? Yeah. So he would come, and we would get herbed up during the performance. Which...
It's nice that your boys are here for that.
Yeah, it is, isn't it?
Yeah.
Well, his son called him and says, "Dad, you smoked pot?" And so we would go behind the dumpster, you know, I'd do it at the end of the performance. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to, you know, ruin the car sales. And so we got completely loaded, and we come out, and no one was there to pick up the Lone Ranger to take him back to the Red Carpet Inn mm-hmm. on Moorhead Street. So he looked very uncomfortable. I had an old beat-up Volvo. Mm-hmm. And I said, "Well, Mr. Moore, you know, can I give you a ride home?" He says, "Well, sure." So we get the
still in the Lone Ranger suit.
We get him in the back seat of the Volvo. Mike and I, we can barely see the road. We get onto the thing, and we're driving like this in the Lone Ranger. We're being really quiet. The Lone Ranger is in the back seat. Mike's, you know, doing like this, you know, checking his hair. And we're trying not to look stoned is the other thing we're trying to do. So we get in 5 o'clock traffic, and some guy is upset that we're on this Independence Boulevard. He's upset that it's all jammed. He backs, and it's a Buick, and it's a middle-aged man. I'll never forget him. And he backs into my car, and I can hear my headlight crunch.
Oh, no.
And he pulls out, and he turns off like this. Well, I go, "That guy crashed into me." So I get into Volvo, and I gun the thing, and we're chasing the guy through Charlotte, North Carolina, and the Lone Ranger's in the back seat, emotionless, just in the back seat like this, back and forth, and the mask and the whole thing. So I'm in the Volvo, and so finally, I gun it, you know, and it gets right in front of the Buick, and I pull off, and Mike and I jump out, and I go, "Man, you crashed into my car." And he gets out. He says, "No, I didn't." I said, "Yes, you did. You backed into me, and you broke my car." And he says, "Well, what do you want?" I said, I'm going to call the cops. He says, "Oh, really? Well, who do you think they are going to believe? You two hippie freaks or me?" And the Lone Ranger gets out from the Volvo.
"They'll believe me, citizen."
And the guy goes, "I didn't know it was you." And that's a true story.
There you go.
J. Thomas, who told that story over a dozen times on Letterman Show, he was as much a part of the Christmas show as Darlene Love singing "Christmas Baby, Please Come Home." Died yesterday at the age of 69 from a long battle with cancer, and that is certainly what he's best known for. Speaking of talk show guests, I got an email from a listener named John Burbage, who listens from Katy, Texas, and he writes to me. He says, "Paul, I've been a longtime reader of your blog and listener to your podcasts. Not too long ago, you had a man on who hosts the Carson podcast." That's a guy named Mark Malkoff who we had on, a couple of months ago?
Yeah.
He was great. He told a lot of great Johnny Carson stories. John Burbage says, "Being as how I'm 66 now and of the Johnny Carson Show generation, I found the interview very interesting, and I've gone back and listened to some of the Carson podcasts that I missed, and one really caught my attention, and since I seem to agree with you on a lot of your politics and science and skepticism, I have a question to ask. The podcast was an interview with the amazing Kreskin. Now, I grew up in the 60s and 70s watching Kreskin on various shows like Carson and Merv Griffin and Mike Douglas. I thought of him as a magician, and I appreciated him for that. However, over the years, he seemed to be kind of full of himself, and in the interview on that podcast, when he's not telling the host how wonderful he is, he seems to actually be trying to convince us that he's real. I always thought that this I'm a real mentalist was just a part of the act, but apparently it's not. And I'm aware that you know some very capable magicians and illusionists like the amazing Randy and Banachek and Penn Jillette, to name a few. I was wondering, Paul, if you've ever discussed Kreskin with any of them over the years and what their opinion of him was. Kreskin's attitude in the Carson podcast comes off like one of those people who claim to talk with the dead and will help you cross over. The kind of people skeptics have been exposing now for many years. Well, John, your perception of the amazing Kreskin is exactly right. He started out presenting himself as a, hey, look at this mentalism trick I can do. And then later on it was, no, I really have these paranormal abilities, which is all BS. And that's when I started disliking him.
Ugh.
And I have talked to Randy and Penn and some other people about it. They all agree, and you are in good company in feeling that Kreskin fits into the same con man category as John Edward. And then I thought about it, and I remembered a movie that I recommended to John. And I'll recommend to you now. It's called The Great Buck Howard. Did you ever see this, Max?
I have not. No.
You've seen so many movies, I'm surprised you haven't seen that. Well, I'm not really
not
surprised,
one.
Because when it came out, it made no money. I saw it on cable. It stars John Malkovich as a smarmy, Kreskin-like performer who is doing a mentalism act, but he's a has-been. And he hires an assistant, who's played by Colin Hanks, to travel with him. And the director and the writer of this, Sean McGinley, gets the essence of has-been showbiz perfect in this movie. You also get Emily Blunt as Buck Howard's reluctant publicist, and Ricky Jay, who's a master magician. He plays Buck's manager. Tom Hanks is in there as Colin Hanks' father, who's not happy with his son's career choice.
That's a stretch.
Like I said, it didn't make any money. I saw it on cable. It's not streaming. But if you have a Netflix DVD account, they do have it there. I checked this morning, and I can tell you I watched this and enjoyed it a lot more than the last few times I saw Kreskin doing his I am really doing the mentalism bit. It's called The Great Buck Howard.
Hmm.
You might want to check it out.
There is a condition that is recognized by con men and shysters and scam artists and charlatans where if you do the con long enough, sometimes you can start to believe your own snake oil.
Oh, really?
Yes. And it's an actual mental thing where if you rip off people enough with whatever you're doing, eventually you know what? I am psychic. I can really do these things. And, of course, you start to develop some mental problems, which is kind of amazing. So maybe that's what happened to Kreskin.
Maybe that explains it.
Yeah.
He bought into his own hype
exactly.
For so many years.
Yes.
Speaking of buying into your own hype, Jerry Lewis died last weekend.
Oh, yeah.
Were you a Jerry Lewis fan?
In a sense, I thought he was fun and funny. I saw him at the Fox Theater one time.
Oh, you did?
One of the funniest shows I've ever seen. He was really, really funny on stage, had a good stage presence. But I got disillusioned the more I found out how big of a jerk he was to people and just everyone around him, how big of a jerk he was, which really disappointed me.
Look at his last interview ever, which
that was horrible.
And that turned out to be his last interview.
And I felt bad for that reporter.
Absolutely.
That was sitting there trying to talk to him.
Just
and
do
be
his
nice
job.
To him.
And being respectful to him.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, what a jerk.
Now,
it's like,
on the other hand, you got to give this guy credit for raising, I don't know, $1 billion?
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
It's ironic. We're coming up on Labor Day, and Jerry Lewis was kicked off that telethon, what, 7 years ago maybe,
oh,
in 2010?
Yeah.
Something like that. But
and
he did it for like 50
like
years and raised all that money. And that, you know, that if that money really went for research and helped out kids, then that's a good thing.
Yeah.
But the way he did it.
Oh, yeah.
Oh, you know, he would use those moments on that show to rant against people who he thought had slighted him in some way.
Yeah.
And, oh, it was the ugly side of him came out very, very easily.
Mm-hmm.
And you can see where, you know, his movie, The Nutty Professor, had kind of the nerdy professor who turned into Buddy Love.
Yeah.
This smarmy kind of thing.
Yeah.
And people said, oh, he's doing both the Jerry Lewis character and the Dean Martin character. No, I think he's doing the Jerry Lewis character
Lewis,
and the Jerry Lewis real person.
Yeah.
But he didn't go off on, like you were saying, how he would go off and people that slighted him. He didn't do that all through those years. He did that in his later years. That's why he got kicked off, right?
No. He was doing it in the middle years
really?
As well.
I never paid attention to that.
No, towards the end, he got kicked off because he was saying homophobic stuff, and he made a couple of racial remarks, and the MDA people said, okay, we can't take any more of this.
Okay.
But he always would do that because he would get upset about things that, you know, normal people would go, okay, let it go. And he could not let things go.
Yeah.
And he would just kind of be out of control with that.
If you're not a big fan of his comedy, I would recommend the Martin Scorsese film, The King of Comedy.
Yes.
Which is a disturbing, dramatic film with De Niro, one of his best roles, Rupert Pumpkin. And he's a guy, who is obsessed with Jerry Lewis's character.
Yes.
And he's playing sort of a version of himself. And it's just an incredible film.
Yeah. I agree. Turner Classic Movies is going to, on Labor Day, which used to be Jerry Lewis's day,
right.
They're
going
to do a Jerry Lewis marathon, and they're going to show The King of Comedy and The Nutty Professor and I guess a bunch of his other some of the others that are out there. And that's all the stuff we have on the Showbiz Show for you today here on the Big 550 KTRS.